Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Bloody awesome! Bloody awesome! Bloody awesome! Bloody awesome! Bloody awesome! Bloody awesome! Bloody awesome!
Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. My name is Matt Hudson from What I Watch Tonight, and joining me from across the pond for our first proper show of 2024, it's John Burke of BurkeReviews.com. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very well, Matt. Ready to start the new year with a review of, you know, a movie.
Yeah, it's a movie. I thought you were going to say with a splash, and I was going to pat you on the back for the dad joke, but you didn't. Now I feel awful for saying it myself, for putting it out there in the world. I say our first proper show of the year. This is obviously a come down from the glitz and the glamour and the sex, drugs and rock and roll of the Bampies last week. If you want to know what our favourite films were of 2023, maybe the most disappointing film, and all of the Oscar categories as well that we partake in, go back and listen or actually watch the Bampies from last week. It's a bumper episode. We don't ever go that long, but it's once in a year we go a little bit longer. If you're on Spotify, you can watch it as part of the app, or it's on YouTube. Check out the link below to watch us for best part of 2.5 hours talking about the last year in film. But now for this week, we are looking ahead for the first kind of real release of 2024, the first original one. And by that, I mean not one which came out in the States 3 weeks ago and has just opened in the United Kingdom. I've been looking around the internet, and most people considering this the kind of first big release of 2024. It's a horror film, John, and the horror film is called Night Swim. Night Swim from Blumhouse, which is sometimes a good thing, sometimes it's not a good thing. We'll give you our thoughts on what side of the fence we fall on in a minute. Until then, let's get to the tail of the tape. It's directed by Bryce McGuire in what I believe is his first feature film outing. He also wrote the screenplay based on a story by himself and Rod Blackhurst. This is based on a short film. That's right. Yeah. Which was pitched to James Wan, who's now teamed up with Blumhouse, and together they're making films. And this is one of them. Now, it stars, we mentioned this off air the other week, and we were quite surprised. It stars Wyatt Russell and Academy Award nominee Kerry Condon, and also stars Amelie Herfely, Gavin Warren, Jodie Long, Nancy Lenahan, and a plethora of tertiary characters. So, you know, fairly small cast, but Wyatt Russell and Kerry Condon certainly give some star power to this, or at least some quality, some legitimacy to this. Now, the first episode of the year. Now, like we said, we haven't said, but I'm going to say now, sorry, this is your first episode. Welcome to the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. We don't drop spoilers on this main episode. And kind of week on week, we decide whether a film needs a spoiler minisode or not. This one, we're not going to do a spoiler minisode for. But don't worry, we're not going to spoil this film for you. The only spoiler I'll give is I'm going to read the synopsis from IMDb, which I know JB's got an issue with. And I am 100% with him on this. The synopsis from IMDb, get this, it reads. And of course, listen, you hear what the film is called, and then you read the synopsis and you think, yeah, that sounds about right. The synopsis says a woman swimming in a pool at night is terrorized by an evil spirit.
Yeah, just to pause for a second. The short film synopsis reads, "A woman swims in her pool at night, but something watches her." So almost verbatim.
Nothing.
The like, and yeah. Well, can I just, I'm going to spoil part of the movie real fast, listeners.
Go for it.
It's not just a woman, and it's not just at night. So yeah, synopsis wrong, like 100% disproven immediately. And I'll even argue, I'm not sure after watching the movie if it is an evil spirit.
I mean,
I don't fully understand.
There's a lot this film does, which I think is convoluted, shall we say, JB. The title was absolutely ridiculous. Here we go. Mm-hmm. Here we go. Let me give you this. The synopsis, that was a synopsis from IMDb, which, as John has just said, is clearly BS. It does not surmise this film whatsoever. Nope. The Google synopsis, however, is a lot more on target. The Google synopsis is, forced into retirement by a degenerative illness, former baseball player, Major League Baseball player, Ray Waller, Wyatt Russell, moves into a new house with his wife and two children. He hopes that the backyard swimming pool will be fun for the kids and provide physical therapy for himself. However, a dark secret from the home's past soon unleashes a malevolent force that drags the family into the depth of inescapable terror. Ooh. You mean that synopsis is more on point with what the film is saying? There are certain words in there which I don't agree with. Dark, malevolent, terror. Inescapable was a feeling I thought watching this, but we'll get to that. So that is what the film is about. Family moves into home. There is a pool in the back garden and all isn't what it seems. So, with Blumhouse, you're either going to get a hidden gem or you're going to get an absolute stinker. Either way, Blumhouse is going to get rich from it because the films are made for next to nothing. The budget for this film is $15 million, which seems quite a lot for a Blumhouse film. But how is it doing critically and with the wider audience? What's the reception been? John, Rotten Tomatoes, the critic score, 26%. Surely the audience are going to come and love this. Nope. 44% for the audience score. Metascore, 42. God damn, the hits keep coming. 5 out of 10 IMDb user score and 2.1 out of Letterboxd. 2.1 out of 5 on Letterboxd, sorry. And if you want to watch Night Swim, if you want your first cinematic experience to be a horror film from Blumhouse, go to the theatre and watch it, because that's the only place that you can see this right now, in theatres only. So that is all the blurb. That is all the... that is all the other stuff out there, the tail of the tape. Let's get to what we think about the film. One more time, we're not going to spoil the film necessarily, but we might go into certain details just to kind of give a little bit more clarity to what we're saying, but we're not going to give any kind of all-out spoilers, certainly for the end of the film. Now, I love horror. You know that, John. Everyone who's been following this podcast on its journey will know I love horror. It's my jam. It's my genre. And the last few years, we've seen Megan, we've seen Scream come out in January and turn the tables on this. You know, January's a dumping ground for films, or big films, certainly horror films. Now, Night Swim is the next film to throw its hat into the ring. And at one point, this was the best film I'd seen all year and the worst, because it's the only one I'd seen all year. It's comfortably going to sit in that latter category, though. This film, John, is absolutely bloody awful. And I put at the end of my review, which is dropped this evening, that it's never nice to criticize a film. Yes, that's what John and I do as film critics, but you don't want to just dunk on a film. But there is literally nothing other than a few minor things in this film which I could point to and say that's a positive. And that is my honest, genuine opinion. And I know lots of other people online have also said this is terrible. It's really not a good film. But it's not. It's a PG-13, which doesn't mean in any way, shape, or form it's going to be a bad film. Megan was a PG-13. I had a lot of fun with Megan. Jaws back in the day was a PG, so you know, take that for what you will. But I just didn't buy into any of this. I think an awful lot of the issues could have been avoided by just simply not going in the pool, which was the first thing. I was like, well, just don't go in. But they have to. Wyatt Russell's character. Goes into the pool, he has MS, and then within a day or two, suddenly he's made this kind of miraculous recovery. The doctors can't believe it. And it's all because of the regenerative powers of the water, which would be fine if the fact that a swimming pool was in no way, shape or form terrifying or scary or even creepy. A horror film should not be boring. And this film is boring. There is no tension. There is no atmosphere. There is nothing here to make me connect to these characters. There is no connection with the family or between the family. Wyatt Russell's character needed so much more of a bond with his family for me to even give a damn about what's going on. Wyatt Russell, a man, he must have got paid good for this film, because he turned up and he is abysmal in this. Genuinely bad. And I think Wyatt Russell was a very talented actor. And, you know, you're in the shadow of your father's one thing. I'm not even going to compare him to the charisma of his father, Kurt. Wyatt Russell's his own man, but I think he's terrible in this. I think everyone's terrible in this. Kerry Condon is the best example of somebody trying here to give a little bit of gravitas to this film, and she's okay, but they are hamstrung by the script here. The script is, like John said, this was a short film. It's been expanded now. The only good thing I can say is it's only 90-something minutes long, so it's short and snappy, but it's very boring. Like John said as well, I've got that on my notes. Why is it called Night Swim when the majority of things happen at the day? Night Swim is a very misleading title. I get it. It sounds very cool, John, doesn't it? Like, Night Swim sounds better than kind of, you know, around the clock dip, but that is what it is. And if you've seen the trailer, you've seen the majority of the major set pieces. The young girl, Amelie Hofele's character, her dedication to keeping her eyes closed during Marco Polo is very commendable.
Dude.
So stupid. There's a moment where a major moment happens where a character seemingly dies in the film. And, you know, everyone watches and they're like, yeah, great. That's over with. Let's just move on. And it was so stupid. And then the reasoning behind the pool being haunted was so convoluted and so stupid and so muddy. And they wheeled out the token Asian spouting wisdom. I was like, guys, what are you doing this for? About this mystical and magical exposition. And she's saying things like, the water used me as a vessel for what must be done. And I thought, good God, somebody wrote that. We get a Google scene as well, so we get somebody doing a quick Google. That's all I needed to do. I mean, I'm going to pass it over in a second, because I am going to go down. I'm going to go for a swim in this absolute dross in a minute. But, you know, there's a few other things. Like, the CG in this is abysmal. There's a moment where you see this monster, and the people I saw this film with, the audience, burst into laughter because it looked so stupid. Exactly.
Yeah, 100%.
Came out of nowhere, and it looks so stupid.
That's now, so bad.
Anything I like about this film, because I have just cacked all over it, and I'm not going to lie, I'm not finished, but I don't want to make this a totally horribly negative review. You know, the initial scene, you know, fine, just get out the water. I liked the idea of the young kid in this. You know, he's swimming, he's waiting for his dad to throw quarters into the pool so he can pick them up, and he obviously practices diving. You know, there's a scene of him swimming and there are quarters being thrown in the pool, and we know something's going on. But I was like, okay, that's a pretty effective idea. I like the idea of that, but it doesn't go anywhere. You know, there was the idea of how the pool became, or the last victim in the pool, the one that we see originally, you know, the how that all came about is actually pretty dark. You know, there was a sacrifice involved. There was two kids and the mum made a decision. I was like, that's pretty dark, but the film just doesn't kind of play on that or even go anywhere with it. So any good ideas this film did have, it was just thrown out of the water. And I don't blame the PG-13-ness of it at all, because we've seen we can get some really good PG-13 films. I just think it's lackluster all over the board, and I've already given it 1 out of 5. Because there was nothing I enjoyed about this film other than the cliche, the ending. Kerry Condon was okay. And I mean that by the end credits. Kerry Condon is decent. Other than that, John, I mean, even the cinematography is bland. The music, I think, lessened the tension here as well. That annoyed me. What did you think? I'm going on here. What did you think, my friend? Surely you love this.
No, I also, I was texting Sean during it, which speaks volumes, because I don't usually text at the theater. But he had, like, I don't think I'm going to see it, he had said to me before I went to see it. And I was like, well, I have to, because we have to talk about it. And I think at some point I was like, this is torture. It's literally so much of this film is them acting like something is going to happen and then nothing happening. And it's not tension. Like, someone might, oh, that's how you build tension. It's not building tension. It's frustration. It is cinematic blue balls. It's the whole time they're like, ooh, is this going to be scary? No, it's not. It's not going to be scary. Oh, how about this? Is this going to? Nope, it's not. And it's not that it fails to scare you. It literally just stops. Like, yeah. It starts to lean towards, ooh, something's about to happen, and then it doesn't. And it does that for, like, the first 30 minutes before anything finally really happens. Now, I'm discounting the opening sequence, but even the opening sequence isn't really satisfying because they don't completely tell you what happens until way later in the movie. So, like, you get this opening sequence that's supposed to be kind of scary. And I've heard a few people, like, comment on the cinematography. Like, you go, like, POV in the pool. But it's so over the top artsy. It's not even artsy. What is it? Like, stylistic, that doesn't actually serve the purpose. Like, we're supposed to be in the POV of Carrie Condon. Is it Carrie Condon? Am I messing?
Yes.
That's right. Swimming. And when it cuts back to her, where we can see her, there's no way that was a POV. Like, she's not doing the motions that the camera was doing. Like, it just, like, style for the sake of style. It's like, ooh, what if we put the camera in the water and you'll just kind of see something out of the periphery? I'm like, no. You, again, just like my issue with Skinamarink from last year was that there was no justification for why we were seeing what we were seeing. It's just, what if? Like, if we were limited to our POV because we were on security cameras, I wouldn't have had a problem with it. They were just, hey, what if we, the filmmaker, chose to show you nothing and then play scary noises on top of it? That's a choice, but I think it's a dumb one. And I think same here. It's like, well, what if we put the camera underwater so you can't quite see things? Because that's how it's like when you're swimming. It's like, okay, is it going to serve a bigger purpose? Or like, well, no, it'll just look cool. Okay, is it going to lead to a scare? No, we're going to just cut to the next scene where nothing is happening. All right, filmmaker, how about we try? Like, if you don't have 90 minutes of a story, then don't make this movie. And that's what it feels like. It feels like, hey, we've got this really great short. They're like, cool, we can't sell shorts. What if we just add a bunch of family crap around it that doesn't really amount to anything? And at the end, we'll act like we had a point and a message, and it'll come to fruition, but it will feel unsatisfying and wholly uninteresting for the 90 minutes that you are watching it. It's like, oh yeah, let's do that. Because that's what this is. It's nothing really redeemable at all. And I want to, like, I have been actively trying to support Wyatt Russell because he's Kurt Russell's son, and I generally like him. But yeah, he seems like he doesn't want to be in this movie, but also is like still trying to be like positive about it. So like you can see in his eyes, he's like, this sucks, but he's trying to be jovial and it's like, it's not working, dude. And the movie like falls apart real hard in the last like 15 minutes because it just goes with every horror cliche imaginable at the end. Like it's just like, okay, we're here now. It's like, but we're not. I mean, this movie, it feels like it wants to be both The Shining and Amityville.
100% Amityville, yeah. And it's got vibes at the beginning as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because again, we have the kids are in danger, right? Which is such a classic thing. But the kids, I don't know if they really are in danger. And yeah, you the joke you made about the Marco Polo, I'm like, girl, at some point you just open your eyes. Like, I can't believe how committed you are to not cheating. Like,
unbelievable.
But worse, because we keep going to her, she has her eyes closed, and we keep going to a POV shot where we can kind of see through the cracks of her eyes. Like, her eyes aren't shut then. Like, either they're closed and you see nothing, or she's cheating the entire time. And at what point do you just open them? And like you said,
respond with Polo.
God, the first creature that pops up, I cackled. I was like, oh wow, that's bad. And like, that happens a lot in movies because it's hard to, like, if a movie takes so long allowing the audience to come up with their own idea of what it's going to look like, it's hard to match the audience's imagination. And a lot of times if you wait too long, it's never going to live up to what the audience has built in their minds. Why a lot of times horror movies will obscure their villains or whatnot, so you can't ever really get a good look at it. We get a real good look at this one, and it's bad. It is so laughable. And, you know, they're trying to recreate the magic of Lights Out, right? Like, Lights Out is one of the in the last 15 years, I think one of the best examples of a horror short that gets adapted to a feature that's really solid. And then that filmmaker has had a really good career, with the exception of a lot of people hate Shazam 2, which I don't hate Shazam 2, but a lot of people did. I hope it's not the end for Sandberg, because I think he's a really good filmmaker.
And he's coming back.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm hoping he's going back to horror too.
His exact words were, well, I paraphrase, but he said, He's coming back to horror. He's got a lot of unfinished business in the genre. He had a great time working on the films he did, obviously Lights Out and the very decent Annabelle creation. And then he said he took a detour through the superheroville, but now he's coming back. So he is coming back to do horror next.
So, like, that's what I was really kind of hoping for with this one. And again, I am a stickler for rules in horror movies, and my big argument for that is always, like, you're writing them. Just make them consistent. Like, you can have them do anything, but make it consistent. Make it make sense. Make sure that the audience understands what the rules are. And at first, when you make the haunting isolated to a swimming pool, it immediately takes some of the tension out for me, because I'm like, well, just don't go in the pool. Yeah. Right? That's the solution. And in fact, we're told that a family lived at this house for approximately 15 years and just didn't use the pool.
Yep.
Had no problems, no issues whatsoever.
There are things going on without getting into spoilers, because there'll probably be somebody out there who likes this film who's saying, well, hold on, the film makes it clear that this isn't this, you know, the pool almost controls or possesses, doesn't it?
So yes.
They're getting inside your head, but still at the same time.
But I don't think the movie, I will argue that it doesn't clearly establish that in a way that is consistent. Right, exactly. Like, yes, they do say that, but why? And even the fact, like, the water, like, they throw this, like, the water's built on a well. It's like, is it, though? Like, is it really? Is, like, doesn't seem like that makes sense. But okay, I guess. You know, there's so many things that are just irritating. And, yeah, it's just, you see, there is potential here. Like, in no way am I saying this filmmaker is terrible and he should never make another movie. But it definitely feels more of like a half-baked idea that they crammed into a feature-length film. And it you know, sometimes a really good director, or he has a, like, clearly he has some style, but it's more than just throwing flair onto a project. It needs to have a function. You know, Scorsese is flashy with his camera work, but it's always to the benefit of the story or to the narrative. And it's not just style for style's sake. And there are filmmakers who are like that. Michael Bay is a lot of times his style for style's sake, but even a lot of times that's not true. We might sell short what he's doing, but his messages aren't really that complex to begin with. This feels like a lot of stuff thrown at the wall to see what sticks. And for me, nothing stuck. It all got washed away or rolled down the drain, whatever, insert water-based pun here. But yeah, it just did not work for me, and I really wanted it to, because we've had some surprise horror movies. The Escape Room franchise, which is, I guess, maybe not quite a franchise yet. There's two movies. I really like those, and those, if I remember correctly, came out like January, February time.
Yeah.
And Happy Death Day was, I think, a February release, which I really love. I don't love the second one so much, but I love the first one. You know, so, like, we've had a good shift in that trend, and I was really hopeful for this one, like, maybe, but not at all for me. It does not work.
Yeah, and it's a shame. We don't want to start the year off with a negative review, but unfortunately Night Swim has given that to us, and there's nothing else really to say about this film other than at one point somebody tries to literally beat the possession out of somebody with a baseball bat, and I just thought, you just don't. I'm pretty sure after the 70 minute mark, everybody involved was like, right, we haven't got a script, so just do what you want, make it up along on the day we get in. Hopefully, I mean, listen, Bryce McGuire's first directorial gig, you know, hopefully he'll get another chance to prove himself, use this as a learning block experience. You know, he would have learned an awful lot from this, as will everyone involved, for better and for worse. Doesn't matter if your film is a hit or a flop, you learn something and you take that into your next project. So hopefully he can go on to show us that this was just a little drop in the pool, when in fact he's going to make a big splash soon. But at the box office, though, this is currently sitting at just shy of $20 million at the box office on a $15 million budget. Now, I'm sure Jason Blum will be hoping for an uplift this weekend, but with what's coming out over the next few weeks and the word of mouth, I'm not so sure it's going to get that. So, JB, anything you want to add to Night Swim before we move on?
No, I think that's all we need to talk about that one.
Right, well, let's move on then, my friends, to our next scheduled segment, which is Concessions of a Cinephile. And here we have a little bit of water cooler chat about anything we want, basically. You know, we may discuss it beforehand, but it's a little bit loosey-goosey in comparison to just talking about, let's say, you know, the big news of the week. However, this week we are talking about the big news of the week, which was the recent Golden Globes award ceremony, mm-hmm. the 81st Golden Globes, which was, of course, held at the in Beverly Hills, at the Beverly Hilton, as ever, and hosted by the tragic Joe Coy. Before I even talk about the winners and the losers, John, I'm assuming you saw the Joe Coy monologue and all that.
I actually didn't see the monologue. I came into it maybe, I guess, 15, 20 minutes late, because I missed both of the supporting actor wins at the beginning, because I didn't expect those to be at the beginning. Apparently, they often are. I guess I've never watched the Golden Globes before, which I didn't realize until, like, yesterday, after I'd already watched this one. I was, like, listening to people say, oh, this is how they always do. I'm like, really? I guess I've always just watched, like, highlights. But, yeah, so I missed the monologue, and I missed the – and I heard enough bad things that I didn't, like, Google it to catch up with it. You know what I'm saying? I was like, eh. Probably fine.
It's not.
I was excited to see who won the supporting role for actress, especially because she was my winner for the Bampies. But I did watch, I would say, about 2/3 of it. I dipped out before the last hour, especially because they already gave Best Director, and I was like, okay, I was like, how are they going to do this for another hour? And then I missed like the first 15 minutes or so. So.
Gotcha. I have no interest in staying up to watch the Globes. It was on at 1 a.m. UK time on the 8th of January. So, of course, that's early evening on the west coast of the United States on the 7th of January. And, you know, the Oscars, I'll stay up late for the Oscars. I usually do. I usually stay up, pull a late one and watch the Oscars and then follow along with all the fun online with the Twitter film Oscar people, sorry, enjoy that kind of stuff. But the Globes, I'm just not really that interested in whatsoever. And even the BAFTAs, I might watch those, but, you know, I'm an Oscars guy. But yeah, Joe Coy's monologue, if you want to listen to it, go and watch it on YouTube. It is quite hard to watch because this guy, his jokes aren't landing, and he's saying, look, I didn't write these, you know, blame the people who wrote these. The only jokes you've laughed at, the ones I wrote. He's throwing the writers under the bus. Not once, three times, I think it is as well. And not more than once, he said, oh, I only got the job 10 days ago, you know, so give me a break. He is up there kind of trying to gain sympathy for his awful hosting at the beginning, his monologue, and blaming the writers. Dude, and there's a great shot from behind him when he drops a gag about character actors, the setup or something about ugly, flat-footed people, and he's like, "Oh, Hollywood calls them character actors," and you just got to look at the faces in the crowd. People are just nonplussed, not pleased. You think Selena Gomez puts her head in her hands at that moment? You can see it all in one shot. It's fantastic. And then he mentioned Taylor Swift, and I know a lot of the Swifties have got upset. I mean, that's the only thing, which I don't think was a bad thing he said, but you know, Swift are going to Swift, aren't they? But for the Golden Globe Awards, NJB, yeah, I mean, it's interesting because obviously we did the Bampies last week, which was, you know, our personal favourites of the year, which don't always align with the Globes, the BAFTAs or the Oscars. But it was interesting, though, to see who took away the big awards. It is a precursor to the Oscars. People do look at this as kind of a precursor to the Oscars. If somebody wins Best Supporting here or Best Actor/Actress, will that then bleed into the Oscars? A lot of people seem to think so, JB. But it was, from what I understand, though, and looking at the list, it was a pretty... there was no real standouts or surprises in the winners list. You know, there's one or two which maybe I would change, but it seems to be a pretty uneventful night in terms of the actual awards. I'm assuming now you've gone through the awards, JB. What are the ones which stood out to you?
Well, you know, I honestly, the winners and stuff were spot on for the most part. You know what I'm saying? Like, I had no real objections to any of the wins. Like, I don't feel like anyone majorly got snubbed. Obviously, the one challenging part about watching the Globes is that it's TV and movies, and I don't watch a lot of TV, so, like, there's a lot of that stuff where I don't care. I did care that we got Io and Jeremy Allen White winning for The Bear, because that was one show I did watch and love. So I was very excited to see both of them win, especially Io's been just in such an incredible year, 2023 for her. I think every cinephile in the world is like fallen in love with her as an actress because she's just in so many things. Nolan winning director, I think is a big precursor. I think it kind of cements the likelihood he gets the Oscar. And for fans like me, I think we feel long deserved. I don't think he should have got it for Tenet, but I would have easily given it to him. I don't know, I was shocked he didn't get it for Dunkirk. I was really surprised he didn't get it for Interstellar. I could see it for Inception. And honestly, you know, Dark Knight would have made sense too. Although maybe they would have, maybe people would have put the asterisk next to it because of the Ledger thing. But I'm a huge Nolan fan. And then hearing his speech when he won was huge for me because I think, you know, when you like compare him to Snyder seems to think highly of himself. And I think Nolan thinks highly of himself, but there's like that subtle difference of, you know what? It's the American British thing. As much as it pains me to be the one saying that, since I am the American, but it's like the brash, overly confident, arrogant personality that Snyder seems to come off with. And Nolan comes off as very humble and confident, but also like kind and loving. Even in his acceptance speech here, he refers back to Heath Ledger, and then he talks about Robert Downey Jr. He says Cillian's his partner in crime for 20 years. Like, there's so much kindness, and even I heard someone say that I think that it was like he expected it, but I don't know. I didn't feel that when I heard it. I just was like, I mean, I think he deserves it. I think he has proven himself time and time again. He is clearly passionate for this craft and for the art behind it, while also making movies that are much more blockbuster-esque in most cases. I would say Oppenheimer maybe is his most prestige-y type movie, even over The Prestige, where there is the nature. Yeah, the nature of a biopic is lends itself towards Oscar bait. But the way he did it isn't, you know, like he didn't go at this as a normal biopic. He did it the way Nolan does movies. He messed around with time. He played with this idea. He cross cuts throughout the entirety of the film, things he's done time and time and time again, things that people who are fans of appreciate. So, I was really into that. I love that Lily Gladstone won. Oppenheimer won Best Picture?
Oppenheimer won Best Drama.
But yeah, I forget the Globes also. I do like that the Globes does comedy. I just wish it didn't merge it with musical. We've talked about the genre thing a few times. I'm all for more genre awards because I think it would be cool for movies to be represented that will never get the opportunity or rarely get the opportunity. Like horror films rarely get the opportunity. And those, I think, are important to the industry. I think they, you know, a lot of actors start in those genre films and then they work their way to the dramatic prestige roles. It'd be nice to see them getting honored early on and having those categories, especially, you know, even if I would be for it being televised, but even if they didn't televise it, like, you know, have a precursor, you know, awards that, you know, these are our genre awards the day before or whatever, you know, something like that. But and Poor Things getting a lot of love was exciting for me because a lot of people haven't seen that yet, but I'm a huge Yorgos Lanthimos fan and I really love Poor Things a lot. Obviously it was my number five. I think it was five. So it's cool getting to see it get its recognition.
Yeah, I'm seeing it this week. It comes out this week in the United Kingdom. So I finally get to see it and see what all of the... It's funny because not to make it a Poor Things episode, but there's a lot of people now... I don't know if it's a seemingly new backlash, but it seems to be a backlash against the film and Emma Stone's, what she's being asked to do in the film. And the, I haven't seen a film, but I'm aware that the character is, has I don't know how to put it, but she is a kid in an adult's body or something along those lines. I know that. And I know a lot of people are getting pretty upset about some of the portrayal she's being asked to do. I don't know what it's all about, but I know is, sorry, go on.
I think that's ridiculous. Because one, that is part of the commentary of the film, but two, Emma Stone and Yorgos have a really good relationship, and like all of her, it's not exploitative at all. Even though she is naked through a lot of it, it's a different it doesn't feel male-gazy in a way that other films would have made it feel. And she seems in power in those scenes, which I think is important to the character, actually. But
that's it. And Emma Stone wouldn't have said yes to this if that wasn't the case. And I mean, look at what Barry Keoghan did in Saltburn, probably to a much smaller degree, but I wasn't really hearing the same things about that. You know?
Yeah. And I mean, I knew Lanthimos is not for everyone anyways. And I knew this movie would have backlash when I saw it. Cause it's like, well, this is not a mainstream movie but it has mainstream actors in it. And it has Wes Anderson vibes, especially aesthetically, like costume and production. But like, what if it was almost like, I feel like it'd be overselling Tim Burton, but it's like, what if Tim Burton and Wes Anderson movies had a baby kind of vibe? You know, it's not quite as gothic as a Tim Burton film, but it's still like that weird. And again, Lanthimos has a very distinctive voice, but his style has changed. I think none of his films look exactly the same. You know, this is more in line with the costuming of like The Favorite than it would be from Lobster or Killing of a Sacred Deer, which are much more modern in their style and setting. This also feels...
Jean-Pierre Jeunet.
There it is. I was like, I know it's Jean-Pierre. Like there's that kind of, the color palette has that kind of pop to it. Reminds me more of not as much Amelie as much as City of Lost Children, but yes. that kind of aesthetic to it, which I really, really mesh with. It's not for everyone, but I was excited to see it getting some love at the Globes.
Nice. Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it this week and just hearing your opening salvo there puts any kind of issue I would have had at rest. I wouldn't have gone in with the idea that it was an exploitative film or anything like that. But now I trust what John says. I'm just going to put it down to the usual, you know, cover your ears, some people, but internet outrage syndrome. So back to the Globes.
I was going to say with the Globes, a couple of things that really bugged me while watching it that I thought maybe showcased the problems with the actual production of the Globes is like every time someone won, they did not know how to get to the stage from their seat because it's like round tables and everything's kind of like clustered. And like you seeing these, you know, celebrities in these expensive outfits look lost and look scared and look nervous because they're afraid of like, they're going to trip or they're going to fall and it would take so long for them to get up there. They would give their speech and they were quickly being rushed off of the speeches, which is fine to a degree, but especially if it's consistent, if everybody's being rushed off versus like you rush off the poor sound guy, but you let the other person talk or whatever, or you rush them off because they're talking political or whatever. Like if everyone's being consistently, you get 30 seconds, that's it. Cool. I'm okay with that. But like when they would do the announcers like segments, when they were getting ready to announce the awards, they would have the announcers turn their back on the live audience. Which is like a weird choice.
Yeah.
Which I understand, like, okay, you've positioned the camera here, but it's like they're really presenting it to the audience more so than they are to the TV viewer. Like, we're watching because we want to see all the celebrities. So it's weird to like put them behind you. And then obviously all of them felt really badly written for the most part. There was a few that worked. The Costner America Ferrera one was bad. America Ferrera was trying real hard to make it work and it was just not working. Those are the two things I thought with the production. It just felt really badly decided. And I don't know if there's a better situation for them getting to the stage, but I do feel like maybe you need to have a plan. And it did not seem like they had a plan because where people were sitting was so random. And there's two different like layers of that. You know, the Oscars is more of a traditional theater thing and it takes them a while sometimes, but nowhere near as awkward as it was at this place.
Yeah. They've been doing the Globes at the Beverly Hilton for about the last two or three decades. It's, you know, I think it's like the early 90s they've been doing it here. So it's not like it's a new building and they haven't quite worked out all the kinks or the floor plan. They've been doing it in the same room for almost 40 years. So not entirely sure about that. But yeah, I mean, the ceremony, it just, everything about it just looked and felt smaller. And I've watched all of the highlights. I've watched the clip of Christopher Nolan's wonderful speech. I respect the American, British differences there, JB well said, well handled with him and Snyder. And I've just the room just looks kind of cramped, and that doesn't really help for me. I know a lot of people put a lot of prestige into globes. I don't necessarily, but that's not for me to then project on everybody else. But just seeing how cramped everybody looked, it just felt smaller. It isn't the Oscars, it isn't whatever, but it just felt that bit smaller. But they have got a ton of categories. And as we said up top, I don't think there's any real surprises in the winners. I think most of them were expected. Even if I'd say, I wish that one had won, I think most of them were expected. Oppenheimer was up for 8 Golden Globes. Barbie was up for 9. Barbie went home with a few. It took home a new award, which was kind of a little wink and nod to what the Oscars wanted to do. Barbie won the Best Cinematic and Box Office Achievement Award, basically the biggest earner of the year, which is obviously the Oscars were going to do that most popular award, which quite rightly got hounded out of town. And What Was I Made For, Billie Eilish's song from Barbie, won for Best Original Song. Now, I was hoping I'm Just Ken would win. So if I had to make a decision, and I love Billie Eilish and I love the song, I'm giving it to Gosling and Ken, man. But, you know, and look, Eilish won the Oscar the other year. You know, let Ken have a go. Give us some of that Ken energy. But no, it's a really good song, What Was I Made For? And Billie Eilish is I really like her music. So very pleased with that. But Oppenheimer, won Best Drama. That beat Killers of the Flower Moon. It beat Maestro. Like you said, Nolan took home Best Director. Cillian Murphy won for Best Actor. Robert Downey Jr. took the Supporting Actor. Ludwig Göransson took the Best Score Award. So Oppenheimer is going into the Oscars with a full head of steam. I fully expect Oppenheimer to sweep the board as much as possible at the BAFTAs, obviously because of the whole Nolan and the British angle to this. I expect it to do well there. And yeah, like I said, Lily Gladstone made history with her win. She delivered part of her speech in the Blackfeet language to honour her Native American heritage, which was very cool to see. Again, it's a culture and a language of which I'm not au fait with, but I'm always so interested to see people bring in a little bit of themselves to these, you know, admittedly lavish, garish, star-studded events. You know, lots of people would say there's a vanity to them, and there is, of course there is. And that's part of the reason why we love it. So to see Lily Gladstone, who looked great on the night, you know, conversing in her native language, I thought that was fantastic. But other than that, not an awful lot of surprises. Divine Joy Randolph won for Best Supporting Actress for The Holdovers, which was your choice for the BAM piece. There was an awful lot of television stuff, and I've heard of all of these TV shows, but I never watched any. Anatomy of a Fall won for Best Screenplay. I have no issue with that. I think it was damn good. It also won Best Non-English Language Motion Picture. Of course, I would have given it to Past Lives, but Anatomy of a Fall was really very good. The Boy and the Heron, though, John, this has surprised a lot of people, and I want to get your thoughts on this because we both really enjoyed that film. But in the best animated, the best motion picture animated category, you had Suzumi, great; Wish, pretty good; Super Mario, fine; Elemental was okay; and then you got Spider-Man, Across the Spider-Verse, and The Boy and the Heron. And Miyazaki's film won. And a lot of people are saying, wow, that's a huge upset. What are your thoughts? Because we both love both of these films.
I mean, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse was my number one movie, period, not just animated. So I totally understand giving it to Hayao Miyazaki and Boy and the Heron. And it's definitely got more prestige behind it. And given the nature of the votes, right? Like, that's my concern. Is that I think it's going to get votes because people are going to have that prestige behind it, even if they didn't see it, you know, especially with the Oscars. Like,
oh, can the you animated see it category, the
I didn't think so, but, and obviously Globes are not a guarantee of a precursor. Yeah. We've seen movies get win and then be completely shut out of the Oscars as a result. But yeah, I am much more worried now that Spider-Verse may not be a lock. Like, I kind of thought it was a lock. Because it just has like so much going for it. And Boy and the Heron, obviously great movie. Not in any way am I saying it's not, but it didn't have nearly the pull. Like, even just as a theatrical release, like, it did not come locally to me still, you know? And I think it's already pretty much out of theaters at this point. And Spider-Verse was in theaters for like ever, you know, and that was at the heat of the summer, right? Like that wasn't like in December at, you know, when there's nothing coming out for like, literally there was a weekend in December where nothing came out.
Yeah.
And Boy and the Heron still didn't go full everywhere. Like it went wide, but it wasn't everywhere. It wasn't in every single major chain. And I know that simply because it wasn't here. I had to drive to see it. That element is kind of more of the shock to me that it was a smaller release, you know, and yet it's Hayao Miyazaki. It's his last movie, probably. And to be fair too, the Oscars have snubbed him most of his career, with the exception of Spirited Away, and I mean, before Spirited Away, I think it was almost like no nominations, even much less the years he didn't win. You know,
I think
gets nominated.
There's a couple, yeah, and even Joe Hisaishi has never been nominated for his work on the scores for any of the films.
So you know, it is one of those things where like maybe that history or that, you know, that part of the history will influence the decisions. And then again, I think a lot of the Academy voters don't watch animated films. They've literally made that joke at the freaking presentations, you know,
which is ridiculous.
So like, I think that plays a factor too, is that they'll know Spider-Verse because it's Spider-Man. It has a big cast in it, you know, Oscar Isaac's in it, blah, blah, blah. But the voice cast for Boy and the Heron is huge. It's Hayao Miyazaki, so there's prestige behind it. And then winning the Globes, I think it's more likely that it wins the Oscar now than it was before the Globe win.
Okay, then I'm throwing all the questions at you here, my friend. I'm throwing all the bombs. It's not even a bad question. I think it's a question I'd love to know what you think. In terms of film circles, and in terms of the critics, in terms of what we do, and it's just in terms of the people who are perennially online talking about films of who we respect, do you think they'd be surprised? Do you think it'll be a surprise in the film community if The Boy and the Heron wins, given the assumption that from a lot of us, Spider-Verse will win? Do you think it'll be called a surprise in the industry? Obviously, the wider audience, the kind of quote-unquote casual fans, will probably say, oh man, I thought Spider-Man would win. What's this one about? What's this Boy and the Bird all about? But in terms of the people in the circle, do you think it'll be a surprise to them?
I don't know, man. Like when I listen to the year-end review stuff, I've heard Spider-Verse on list way more often than I've heard Boy and the Heron in like the top 10. I think there is a big appeal of Spider-Verse, like just obviously, especially, I mean, when you look at a year that had 7 superhero films and most of them weren't good, you know, like, or like did badly, I should say, even more so than weren't good, you know, like they just legitimately did not do well. Spider-Verse is the exception to that. I think there's some room, for I've totally lost my train of thought, man. I do think it seems like Spider-Verse is respected in all of those areas, in the film circles, in the cinephile. I know a few people who didn't like it that blew my mind, but and obviously I think Spider-Verse has one major criticism that you hear over and over again from people, which is that it's not a complete movie, which I don't agree with at all.
That's not a criticism which I'll allow, because we knew there was another film coming,
and a lot of people, and even so, I still think they finish this film. I think they give you a epilogue and or a prologue to the next movie at the end of this movie, but I do feel like the story of this movie concludes. And the Boy and the Heron, though, arguably it's confusing at times, some of it feels disconnected, and it is, whether intentionally or a result of having to share the workload for a change, something Miyazaki has not done previously, as all the legends report. So both movies have their criticisms, and to me, a lot of people are, even if they do have that issue, like that, it's always a caveat. I think this movie's great, except that, you know, I think it's great, except for, and that's like the one little nitpick, right? Both movies are exceptional, and so I don't know. I would love to see Spider-Verse still win. I do think it's the better movie of the two. As much as I like Boy and the Heron, it's not my favorite Miyazaki, and I don't think it's as impressive. God, that seems weird to say, because I totally think it's impressive. I think it's very impressive. I just think Spider-Verse is that much more impressive. Like, all of the things it's doing, all of the layers and the evolution from the previous film. It shouldn't be able to top itself, and it seems like it does. I never fully felt that way, because I love Into the Spider-Verse so much, but I've heard a lot of people making the argument that the second movie elevates the material even more, and I was just like, I think it's on the same page as the first movie, but
I think it elevates it, but I mentioned that in the Bampies, but only because I think I don't mean that elevates it because the first film was so badly written or anything like that. I just mean it took what was so good about the first film and it didn't deviate off course. It continued with that and it gave a very rich experience, which for me has taken what came before and has taken it up a notch, because they haven't rested on their laurels. They haven't just done the same thing. They have carried on the trajectory, and it's gone in an upward fashion for me, which would then essentially mean it's elevated it. But I also know what you mean, that there are other people who kind of almost putting down, like you say, Into the Spider-Verse by saying that, when Into the Spider-Verse was, when it came out, I was like, this is the best superhero film of the year. It's one of the best films of the year. And similarly with Across the Spider-Verse, it won both of our best animated features last week at the Bampies. I would love to see The Boy and the Heron win, regardless of what I chose as my best animated feature, because of the romanticism around it. But there is also that little bit inside me, JB, that Into the Spider-Verse won best animated feature. Now, let's just say, hypothetically, Across the Spider-Verse wins as well. We could be looking at, I think, we could be looking at the first ever trilogy of films, each to win a Best Something Feature Oscar. In this case, it would be Best Animated. All three of the films could be Best Animated Feature, which would be historic. But I don't want, for example, Miyazaki to be overlooked just for a kind of hypothetical, or wouldn't it be cool if the Spider-Man films all won the Best Animated Feature? I could very much see a scenario where The Boy and the Heron wins. And I think in film circles, I think it will be seen as a good thing. I don't think there'll be too many people other than the more superhero-centric outlets who would be too upset. I think people would just be saying, hopefully, that, wow, we got so many good animated films this year, or at least a few. We got those two. We got things like Suzumi, which is in there. I know you really liked Eternals. Elementals, not Eternals. Jesus. Elemental. So there was. I'd like people to think, well, in a year where there was a few great animated films, you know, we're all winners here. But we'll see. We've only got a few weeks now until the Oscar nominations are revealed, probably about a month now. But wrapping up then with the Globes, Paul Giamatti, I know you loved him in The Holdovers. He won for Best Performance by an Actor in a Musical or Comedy. Poor Things won the Motion Picture for Musical or Comedy. And Oppenheimer won the Best Motion Picture for Drama. Like we mentioned earlier on, I believe that's all of the awards. Yes, it is, all the ones we've mentioned. So that is the Globes. Nothing really stood out there, I think, other than Joe Coy's kind of tone deaf monologue. It's, you know, it wasn't great. The jokes weren't very funny, but it wasn't like he wasn't the worst thing he did was throw his fellow writers under the bus and try to put self-pity on himself when he really didn't need to. Other than that, I think it's a pretty inoffensive ceremony. People, the right films won, according to most people. There were no mishaps. Nobody opened up the wrong envelope. It was a pretty straightforward Globe. So we haven't got any drama or controversy to talk about this year. Apologies to that, everybody. And for those who want to know, Succession won Best Television Drama. Kieran Culkin, Sarah Snook, and Matthew McFadyen took home Golden Globes for their performances in that show as well. I haven't seen it, but my buddy Luke Bly of Star Wars Sessions tells me it is a fantastic show, one of the best shows he's seen in the last decade. Obviously behind The Mandalorian season 1 and 2, of course. But yeah, the Globes, JB, anything else you want to add then? Anything which you've seen from the Globes which makes you think we're going to see anything wild at the Oscars?
No, I got nothing else to add. I'm ready to move on. Enough with the Globes.
Let's
do it then.
Let's move on from the Globes. Next up will be the BAFTAs, and then the Oscars, and then the litany of association awards that will be coming out very, very soon. This is a bit, man, I love this. It's like Christmas for film fans. I love the awards. we don't all put stock in all of them. I'm not a huge fan of the Globes, but I still enjoy seeing who won because it does lead up to the Super Bowl, which is the Oscars. And I know not everybody likes that, but I do. I love the Oscars. And I know we'll be covering that here on the BAMP as well. But until then, let's move on to our next segment, JB Media Consumption, where we talk about the movies, TV shows, video games, music, podcasts, which aren't ours, whatever we have used to pass the time since our last episode. JB, what you been checking out?
Well, I've gotten back into wrestling, which nice. If you look through my life, it has always been kind of like a roller coaster, like really into it in the like mid-80s when I was young. I was super into it. I kind of fell off in the early 90s and then came back just before the Attitude Era really picked up, and then dropped off in like the early 2000s right after the WCW-WWE merge. Like I was into it for about 6 months and it kind of was like, well, done. And then I got back into wrestling like 2009 until about 2014 or so. And then I've been pretty much like, it's always kind of around, even those times when I'm not watching it, I'm like aware of it, but I'm not watching it. And the last year or so, I've slowly been kind of like keeping up with it more and more. It's been like creeping onto my Instagram page and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like actively watching WWE and AEW. And it's, you know, it's easy to throw on. Sometimes it's very cringy, like some of the performance stuff where it just feels so like they're trying to improv, but it feels improv, which never works for me in any scenario. I don't like I love improv that feels organic and natural. I hate improv that feels like improv. Yes. And a lot of it does feel like that where you're like, you want to talk some trash? It's like, oh. Nobody talks like that. Come on. Like, it sounds so fake.
They've done that in wrestling for the last 50 years, though.
But the ones who are good at it, like, and obviously there's standouts throughout history of wrestling, like The Rock yes. being one. I think Cody Rhodes is really good on the mic. CM Punk has always been incredible on the mic. Even sometimes he'll say things where I'm like, I feel a little cringe, but he just sells it.
Yeah.
And then there
could
are
be like Ric Flair and just be coked out of your face and just woo all the time.
Yeah, but
back in the old days,
early Flair really was good at cutting promos. Later, like especially like WWE, like post 2000s Flair, very clearly like not fully aware of what's going on. And he's back right now, not wrestling.
Jesus,
but Sting is retiring after all these years, like in March on AEW, and he brought Flair in as like a manager. So Flair is managing Sting for like the last two months of matches, and Flair does look like he is a little lost at times. Like there's times where he looks like he has no idea what's going on.
Getting on a bit now. We both agree that the Iron Claw shows that there is only one Ric Flair when it comes to charisma mm-hmm. and just natural exuberance. You cannot duplicate that.
And the Iron Claw is part of the reason that in the video games got me kind of back into wrestling slowly, and then that was like because I need a distraction, and sometimes like movies or TV are too, I have to pay too much attention. Wrestling, I can kind of just look up when I want to. It's performative sports. Like, you know, I am aware that it is scripted, but it is far from fake. And again, if you've ever listened to any wrestling interviews, they get real offended when you call it fake. Scripted, they're okay with. And kayfabe, which is the idea that it's real. That was the old, like they would pretend that everything was like, as far as like the views and stuff, that's kind of faded, and there's like more of a meta quality. I think it's essential with social media because so many of the wrestlers are on social media. They tend to break kayfabe a little more in interviews and stuff now than they used to. Like they acknowledge that part of the business, but they're doing stunts on live TV that are severely dangerous. Like they're taking huge risks. And I'm pretty sure I saw a dude's nose get broken like two nights ago. I was watching AEW on Saturday night, and the dude's nose got like, I think he got hit on accident, and the amount of blood that was coming out of it was like, that's not fake. Like that wasn't intentional.
The obvious one, but I always loved going back to this, but I remember because I used to watch it during the Attitude Era. I used to watch it when I was younger, but obviously the Attitude Era kind of came around at the right time for guys of the same age of you and I, but the Hell in a Cell, man, when Undertaker throws Mankind off the top of the cell. I get it. Yeah, I've always understood the kayfabe and the agreed angles, but try and tell me that being thrown 20 feet off a cell onto a table onto a floor through everything else isn't going to severely hurt you. And it did. It really messed him up, Mick Foley. And if I came over to Florida, and I hope this happens, and you suplex me, onto a surface, it's going to hurt me, and it's probably going to hurt you as well. And just stuff like that. I know what you mean. It's whilst it may not be like full on whacks and kicks and punches, you know, these guys are still getting roughed up each night.
Yeah, and but I've been watching wrestling, and then not nearly as many movies. I caught Anyone But You again. Second time I saw it, but this time my wife wanted to go, so we went and saw it in the theater.
Did she like it?
She did. Yeah. I think I might have liked it a little less the second time. I don't know. I don't know if that's fair. I still like Glenn Powell a lot, and I think Sydney Sweeney is solid. Some of the jokes just aren't great, but this time I was very obsessed with. I've never read. Crap, I forgot which Shakespeare it's based off of. I've not read the Shakespeare and or seen the movie Much Ado About Nothing. I didn't realize it was that based on it until this run. So like I was really focused on that. So that might be why I was like maybe too academically watching it, where I was like, ooh, that's this, that. And I was also trying to like simultaneously read the plot of Much Ado About Nothing, because I've never read that particular work of Shakespeare. But caught the 1976 Star Is Born. It's not good. Watch the Bradley Cooper one instead. The Holdovers, I rewatched. Love that movie. That movie went up in my ranking having rewatched it. The Settlers, which is a new film that my review is up at disappointmentmedia.com. I watched Michael Clayton.
Aha, uh-huh, okay.
Dude, that movie's so good. I've never seen it.
The guy who's doing Ander, isn't it?
I'm not even sure.
Gilroy.
Oh, yeah, I think you are correct. And then George Clooney, Tilda Swinton, incredible in it. And then, I'm going to feel terrible. The guy just died. Is like the third lead.
Tom Wilkinson?
Yes, man. Not the reason I watched it, but it was like good. It was a few days after he passed that I decided to watch it. He just happened to be in it. And I was like, okay. This has been on my watch list for a while. Blank Check's talked about it. The Big Picture Show is a big supporter of it. It's on the rewatchables. Like, it's a movie that people I really admire their opinions on film have been raving about. And I just never really had any reason to watch it before. Finally did. And it's excellent. And then playing Baldur's Gate 3. I'm very much into that game. It's a lot of fun. I do have the nudity turned off though. Yeah, it's apparently it can get very graphic if you want it to be. I don't play video games for that reason.
Even though you could do that.
This game apparently, and I will say, despite not having nudity on it, it is very hard for like, they make romance a predominant part. Like, characters are constantly like, hey, you're hot. And I'm like, stop. I just want to hit that animal thing over there. Like, what are you doing? Like, I'm here to like have adventures, like not sexual adventures, but the game seems to want to push that on you.
Adventure first, drink later.
Yeah. But, well, that's what I've been, consuming. What about you?
Not as much this week. And again, rest in peace, Tom Wilkinson, very, very fine actor who's been in many, many good films. I haven't seen any of the films you've watched this week. I certainly haven't watched them this week. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts on them further, though. I've been listening to Dead Meat podcast. I enjoy what those guys do over there. I've been watching them on YouTube, been watching the kill counts. I really enjoy their kill counts. A really fun way to review films. If you haven't seen them, do check them out. Of course, it's all horror-based, so it's very much a bit of me. I watched a film called The Beekeeper. We'll save my thoughts on that, and you'll find out why very shortly. But there's a Sky original film. It was the Unlimited film this week as well in the United Kingdom. And it gets released today, I think, or certainly gets further screenings today upon recording this. But I also saw the new Netflix film, Society of the Snow, one of the bigger films to come out this week. I'll drop a quick review of that on the old Tiki Tok, the BAMP TikTok during the week. But this is based on the 1972 Uruguayan Andes flight crash, which was also told in the mid-90s film Alive, probably most famously for that. However, this film is probably a little bit more consistent with what happened, certainly in the depiction of the characters or the nationality of the character, the cast playing the characters. But I'll give my thoughts on that film on Tiki Tok. Suffice to say, though, I thought it was a very good film. But that's about it though, JB. I haven't really been doing too much. I've been under the weather this week. I wasn't very well this weekend. So I haven't really been doing an awful lot this
week. I'm sorry to hear that.
No, all good. I think it was just a post Bampi's come down. It actually happened like the day after the Bampi's. I woke up and I was like, damn, I feel like death. Was my weekend, was just basically chilling out. But I think I was just so excited for your picks for the Bampi's, plugging our show last week, guys. Go check it out.
That's what it was.
It was the adrenaline. It's like, I can't take this anymore. But no, we're much better now. Thank you very much, JB. And I'm glad the show's back as well. The show's back in its standard format. Obviously, next year we'll be back with the Bampi's in January. But next week we'll be back with a normal show. But before we get there, you know, we have to make sure that we stay bloody awesome in order to give you the bloody awesome movie podcast. Otherwise, we'd be nothing but fakes and charlatans. So, John, please, please, please tell me, how have you been staying bloody awesome in the past week?
So I wrote we have this little note thing that you guys don't see, but I wrote sling it into doctorate. and it's a pun, Matt, because I signed up for Sling TV. I've been a cable cutter for a long time, I think like 8 years or more. And we've dabbled with the different live stream TV, but for like the last couple of years, we really haven't had live TV. Like we have like Hulu where you can get the TV shows like the day after, that kind of thing. But, most part have not had live TV, but because, as I mentioned, I've really been wanting to watch wrestling, I needed a service that had access to USA Network, TNT, and TBS, and Sling was the best option. And I was torn about it. I wasn't sure. And I finally was like, you know what? I'm going to do it for at least a month, because I get when you have too many choice paralysis, right? If I have too many choices to make, I end up making no choice. And so right now, I other than the movies we're watching for like podcasts or for specific reviews, if I'm just wanting to throw something on in the background, it takes too long for me to decide. I'm like paranoid and panicked. Like, I don't want to commit to this, or I'd rather watch. If I'm going to watch this, I want to watch it, and I can't watch it right now. I can't give it my attention. And that's what I love watching reruns, you know, syndicated, like Friends. I've seen through its seasons, like, I can't even tell you how many times I've seen all of Friends, or at least many episodes of Friends, because I would just throw it on whatever channel it was on and just let it cycle. You know, I didn't care. I can jump into any episode because I've seen them all, so I don't need to see it in any kind of sequential order. And I haven't had that option for a while. I mean, technically, there's stuff like Pluto TV and that kind of stuff, but those still feel like you have to make a choice, because it's like, they are very specific networks. Like, it's like, here's a Mystery Science Theater 3000 channel. So I needed something where I could just turn TV on, flip through the channels if I want to, find something that I'm satisfied with, and leave it. And after a lot of deliberation, Sling made the most sense. And again, heavily because I was like, I want to watch wrestling. And Matt, I don't know if you know this, man, but wrestling right now between AEW and WWE is Monday night, Wednesday night, Friday night twice, because there's SmackDown, and then right after SmackDown, there's an AEW show.
Okay.
And then Saturday night, there's an AEW show. And I'm like, that's a lot of nights of wrestling right away. So if I'm needing to like work or write, I can just throw wrestling on in the background and entertain myself while I get stuff done. And so that's how I decided to approach my first semester of the doctorate program. Was like, I need a version of live TV I can just throw on and forget about.
No, I dig it. The sports entertainment isn't a bad thing to put on in the background, my friend. I know you've got a hell of a lot of work going ahead of you in the next few years, but if anyone can do it, John Burke can do it. And I'm glad that you are going to have the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast to give you a little distraction, to give you a little bit of escapism from what's going on in the real world. But no, it sounds very, very interesting, and I hope you can keep up with that wrestling multiple times a week as well. But who knows, maybe that'll be the thing that catapults you towards your doctorate, and it'll be a good memory to look back on. My one is a lot less academic and a lot less educational, but possibly a little bit more painful on the old legs rather than the brain. I've been doing a lot of pounding this week, JB, and by that I should probably give some context. A lot of pounding of the pavement. I've been out running because we mentioned off air, a flippant remark, JB mentioned, like people do marathons, you sign up, you don't quite know what you're getting the other into. Now, I've done a marathon in 2015. I did the London Marathon, 27 miles of hell, but I did it. And then I've also now signed up to do a half marathon in 10 weeks' time.
Oh, wow.
The guys I work with are doing it. One of the guys I work with, he's a very athletic guy, very kind of big built, takes his gym seriously, but not overkill, if that makes sense. Not an entire gym buff. And he's signed up for it and he sent me the link. He said, oh, go on, why don't you do this? This was like last November. I said, I'm not doing that. And then my boss signed up and he's like older than I am. I was like, oh, God damn it. And then somebody else signed up and nobody was saying, oh, come on, do it. You got to do it. But I was like, man, I don't want to be anyone who doesn't do it. So I kind of took it as a kind of outlet of pride, a little bit of ego, because I want to be able to say I've done it. And also and a little bit of competitiveness, but also just the idea of, can you do it one more time? Once I did the marathon, the big one, I was like, I'm not doing any more of that. It hurts too much. It's too much training. And I've done it. Once you've done the big one, what can you do after that other than more big, long marathons? But I was like, 13 miles, I reckon I can do this easily enough. I started doing a bit of training last year, but of course it's all outside. It's a local one, the half marathon. So I haven't got to go anywhere, but it's still 13 miles or however many kilometers that is. And yeah, I was out on the pavement, yesterday and today, just to get the old knees used to running on the pavement again. And man, does it hurt. Man, that's where the cough came from earlier on, because I still need to regiment my breathing. I'm still kind of, if once I start to get out of breath, I start to kind of really sort of from the mouth, when you've got to go nose through your nose, out through your mouth, and the coughing starts where I just cannot get the breathing right. And I've done this many times, I just need to relearn how to do it. Hopefully, and also at the same time, in my long-standing desire to be LB, to be like Burke, it'll also be good for the old weight loss, for the health, for mental health, obviously feeling good about yourself as well. So it will have good ramifications down the line. It's just getting over that first week or two of doing it and get it to become the norm. But I've got 10 weeks, John. I've got 10 weeks. I'd imagine some of these bloody autumns will have a similar ring to it. But listen, I know a lot of the guys, I don't think they listen to this anyway, but they're all kind of going for that 2-hour time. And I'm kind of joking along saying, yeah, I'll beat you all. I've got you all on toast. Listen, in reality, as long as I cross that finish line, that's a huge win for me. I haven't done any exercise fully. I've done it on and off, but nothing major in years. So this will be huge. So
it's big, dude. That's big. It's hard.
It's very hard.
Running on pavement is hard. So
I'm doing it for all the bampites out there. I've got you back.
Good luck, sir. Keep us posted for sure.
Oh, I will do. But I'm looking for the positives, and I will be doing for charity as well. So I'll get some news on that going forward. But that's how I've been staying bloody awesome, JB. It seems like we've had differing paths this week, but no less exciting either way, I'd say.
Indeed.
Now, I mentioned the beekeeper earlier on, and John and myself, we aren't going to be keeping bees, though we do come up with a lot of honey. It's called this show. So next week, we are going to be talking about The Beekeeper, the latest film starring Jason Statham. It's directed by David Ayer of Suicide Squad infamy or fame. But if for any reason we decide, actually, do you know what, we are going to cover Mean Girls the musical, it all depends on whether I can see it or not, we may cover the Mean Girls film. We may or may not. It depends on me. However, The Beekeeper is the film for next week, otherwise, unless something does change. So look out for that. Looking forward to discussing it with JB. Now, In the meantime, we want to hear what you thought about Night Swim. Were we too critical about this film? Did you love it? Did you not like it? Or did you agree with us entirely? Let us know on social media. Please do follow us on Twitter at BAMP_podcast, BAMP_podcast. JB, where are we on Instagram and Threads?
Bloody awesome movie pod, man. I haven't logged into Threads in a minute.
Yes, neither have I, which is why I keep forgetting about it. So Threads, check it out. We're also on TikTok. Like I've mentioned, we drop short reviews of some of the films we've seen outside of our main discussion. So please do go follow us on there. Just search for Bloody Awesome Movie Pod on TikTok, Facebook, Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. And our reviews hit the tomato meter. We are a Rotten Tomatoes approved podcast. So check out the tomato meter for the films we talk about, because you're probably going to see the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast contributing to the score. If you want to follow me to talk about films, you can go to whatiwatchtonight.co.uk or search for What I Watch Tonight across all the social medias, including Letterboxd. John, where are you?
I'm at BurkeReviews.com and at BurkeReviews on all the social media platforms.
Yes, sir. And if you like what we're doing here, we're entering our sixth or seventh year of the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. I do forget. I think it's the seventh year we've been around. We certainly hope you like what we do because we love doing it. But if you wouldn't mind giving us a 5-star review and a rating on your podcast provider of choice, that would be extremely well received by us. It means we can get more listeners in, we can keep growing, and we can hear from more film fans each and every week as a result. But with that, as always, stay bloody awesome.
And keep watching movies.
Blood, 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 bloody, 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 blood, blood, bloody.
Awesome.